I think if you can find the truth and a passion for the speaker, that imposter syndrome will disappear. If they're up there, and most of my clients have something they're really passionate about and want to speak on, if I can get them to focus on that and only that, then a lot of that stage fright, imposter syndrome, because they're speaking from the heart, not the head at that point.
Welcome to the Learn It All podcast with your hosts, Learn It CEO, Damon Lemby, and SVP of Product, Darren Bridget. Our mission is to explore how continuous growth shapes the path to success. Our guests are high achievers who've learned there's always something new to discover. They'll share their stories, strategies, and insights with you. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur, a seasoned executive, an aspiring athlete, or simply someone who believes in the lifelong pursuit of knowledge, this podcast is for you. Join us now for the latest episode as we continue the Learn It All's journey through a world that never stops teaching.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Learn It All podcast. We are Damon Lemby, CEO of Learn It and best-selling author of The Learn It All Leader. I'm Darren Bridget, in charge of all the people skills product that we develop here at Learn It. And today we are joined by the amazing Frank King. Let me give you a little bio on Frank. Here's Frank's. This is the brief story. World record, 12 TEDx talks, 20 years writing for The Tonight Show, 38 years as a speaker, comedian, and coach, calls himself the mental health comedian. We'll get into that in a little bit. A few interesting things. Stand-up comedian sharing the stage with some other famous personalities like Jerry Seinfeld, Robin Williams, and Ellen DeGeneres, holds the record for the longest nonstop comedy club road trip. I will hold back the number and let Frank actually reveal that number later in the session. But Frank, thank you for being here.
It was part of a plea bargain, Darren. I really didn't have much choice.
Never mind. You're still here, and that's what counts. What? I think some of the things that our listeners will learn today, hopefully, a little bit more about if you're interested in public speaking and keynotes and presenting, anything like that. Also, we'll hear a little bit more about mental health and comedy. We're all about learning here. That's what our listeners can learn. But Frank, let me pivot over to you with our new signature question that we're trying. What do you hope to learn to be better at in the next 6 months?
I know it all. So I didn't say that. Yeah, I got to tell you guys, I went on somebody's podcast about imposter syndrome where you achieve all this stuff and then...
He's got anti-imposter syndrome.
Exactly. I am spectacular. I'm just waiting for people to figure that out.
I see. Good. So what you're hoping to learn is that everyone has finally figured out that you know everything.
Yeah. My tagline is often wrong, never in doubt. It's just, no, what I hope to learn is I'm working very hard because I got a bodybuilding contest. I know it's hard to believe looking at me dressed, but I want to get down to 4% body fat, which is the lowest healthy body fat. The first contest I did, I got down to 8 and 138 pounds. I'm trying to get down to 4%. So I'm only eating every other day this month, every third day next month. So I'm hoping to learn the magic formula so that I can win the 40 and over in the bodybuilding category at the contest.
Frank, do you have any Polaroids you could show us? You could show the audience of your last contest?
I do. I don't know.
Probably not.
We'll
put them in the listener notes.
Yeah. We'll be rooting for you.
Thank you. I'm not really working on anything. Oftentimes, I guess if I was studying martial arts, I'd like to learn more, whatever. But I really, my two focuses, I speak and I work out. Part of my self-care plan. Working out. So I was in the gym anyway, and I'm going to write a book one day called Undress for Success, Look Good Naked, because you really can't tell when I'm wearing clothes that I'm in good shape.
Greg, I think that's not so surprising. A lot of people that are on the road, what do you do with your time when you're on the road? You could sit around and drink and buy stuff, or you could exercise.
Yeah, and when my wife and I were on the road, we were the Junior Ward Cleaver of comedy. We were married.
Most
of the guys on the road were married, but single on the road. And they figured you're outside your home zip code. It's okay. Matter of fact, it got so bad that the wives of the other comics would sometimes call what they call the comedy condo, where they put us up rather than hotel rooms, they get a condo. They clean it every week. And so the 3-bedroom. And then the other comics are out enjoying themselves with women from the show. And the phone would ring. And I kept having to handle these crying, where is he? He's still out late. I can't believe he's still out. So I finally bought an answering machine so that I didn't have to, hi, welcome to the Comedy Condo. And I give our names, leave a message. So I didn't have to deal with distraught wives who were sure their husbands were out philandering, which they, in fact, were.
There you go. It's all part of the crazy road culture. Huh?
But, Frank, I want to hear.
There it is. There's the Polaroid.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Is that you, Frank?
That's me.
Wow.
That's imposing.
That's impressive.
That's him posing, and it's also imposing.
That's 66 years old last July.
Wow.
Wow. Way to go.
You, Frank.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's why, like I said, with my clothes on, there's a name for that, by the way. Clothes over your body. They call it a pump cover because nobody can see your pump because you're wearing clothes.
That's right. Okay. Yeah.
See, Darren, you learn something new.
I've already learned the Comedy Condo and the pump culture. Who knows? You've got to be open because there's always new things to learn.
Yes.
So I know Frank through a couple other people set me up, and we've been working together. And Frank's been helping me with my speaking, and I'm honored to have him on today. But one of the things I really wanted to talk about, Frank, was can you share with us your story about how you got into comedy? I thought it was awesome.
Fourth grade, told my first joke. Kids laughed. Teacher was hysterical. I decided at that moment, I'm going to be a comic. 12th grade, there was a talent show. I've been taking drama. Never got a good part. Never got a speaking role. And I thought, you know what? If I do stand-up, I can write, direct, produce, and star my own little show every night.
Yeah.
So I did stand-up at the talent show. I won. Of course, I beat the accordion player and the folk dancer. It's not really a tough win. And then I said to my mom, I'm going to California. I'm going to be a comedian. And she was big into education. Yeah. She said, son, you're going to college first. I don't care what you do when you get done. You can be a goat herder for all I care, but you're going to be a goat herder with a college degree.
Maybe go to college because the whole family's big on colleges. And so I went to college, went to UNC Chapel Hill, got a couple of degrees, and then moved to San Diego. And in San Diego, with an insurance company that I was working for, just by chance, they had an office in San Diego, and they moved me there, and there's a comedy store.
Yeah.
A branch of the world-famous one up in L.A. on Sunset. The comedy store is still there. Same one, same place.
Wow.
So I went to open mic night. Actually, if you're thinking about doing comedy, here's my advice. Go to open mic night a couple times, just watch. Yeah. And see how bad 85% of the people are. And it'll give you the courage to get up and do your thing. And I'm watching these idiots, and I'm thinking, I'm funnier than that, just walking around in the daytime. I got up, I did my first 5 minutes, and halfway through my set, I heard a voice in my head, you're home.
Oh, wow.
So 18 months later, I said to my girlfriend, now my wife of 37 years, I'm going on the road to be a stand-up comedian. You want to come along for the ride? Figured she'd go, oh, hell no. And she goes, yeah. So we gave up the apartment, our jobs, jumped into my tiny Dodge Colt. And we were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop, 7 years and change. Comedy club to comedy club, beer bar to beer bar. And some of those beer bar, juke joint, pool hall, difficult engagements. People screaming, tell us some jokes we can dance to. So it was like playing minor league ball. You're in these little dinky towns that end in Ville.
Yeah.
But it was a great time to be in comedy. There's a big boom from 84 to 94.
Yeah.
And I worked with Seinfeld, Rosie, Ellen, and Foxworthy, Ron White. By the way, Ron White, that was Scotch he was drinking all those years. One of the funniest human beings off stage, even more. He could tell his story.
Yeah.
Worked with Dr. Ken. Dr. Ken show and the three Hangover movies. Dr. Ken Retta, who's been on NBC and in a variety of shows. Yeah, it was a great time. Open up for Lou Rawls, you'll never find. Up for Randy Travis, two nights in a Michigan amphitheater, 5,000 people per night.
Wow.
Oh.
Yep.
So 7 years on the road, somewhere along the way, somebody said, Dad, we need to do something else.
What happened was, comedy's beginning to wind down. I was booked a year ahead because, unlike most comics, I have a work ethic. And a radio station in Raleigh, my hometown, where we used to go and talk about promote the comedy shows.
Yeah.
I always said to them, look, if you ever get in a bind where one of the two morning show hosts can't come to terms contract wise, I'd love to do it. So, sure enough, it's called Reynolds and Silva. And Reynolds, he wanted more money than they were willing to offer. So they brought me in to interview me. And they said, can you take direction? And I said, no, I became a comedian because I don't like taking direction. And 18 months later, they fired me. You know why? Couldn't take direction.
Yeah.
So, oh, yeah. I took a number one. That's not really why they fired me. I took a number one morning show and I drove it to number six in 18 months.
Oh.
My friend of mine goes, man, you didn't drive that in the ground. You drove that in the middle earth. And then the comedy club scene was definitely winding down. So I made the jump to corporate comedy because I was always very clean.
Yeah.
And so that's what they want. The meeting planners, they go, we're paying you how much? $5,000 for 45 minutes of just jokes. I go, no, you're not paying me for the jokes I tell. You're paying me for the jokes I don't tell.
Yeah.
You're paying me so when I get done my job, you still have a job. And that resonates with the meeting planner.
Yeah. That's quite a journey. And along this way, I think a lot of our people that might be listening to this thinking about it's got to be so easy for you to step in front of a TEDx stage or any deliver a keynote, get on stage. But I don't have 10 plus years or 20 years, all these shows and being a comedian. How do you help people that don't have that background? People that maybe actually have that imposter syndrome feeling because they just don't have, I'm not a comedian. How am I supposed to?
And they want to get into public speaking. What's the first step somebody should take to get into public speaking?
I ask them right off the bat, what one problem do you want to solve? Because I believe in public speaking, like comedy. I made a choice, a conscious choice in fourth grade. I'm going to be a comedian. I niched myself.
Yeah.
And then when I got to Southern California, I decided, I looked around, looked at all the other guys. They're wearing whatever they found on the floor that wasn't totally dirty.
Yeah.
And I'm in a jacket, a tie, button down, Weejuns, no socks. When the comedy store, that's where I started, but the improv opened across the way.
Yeah.
And so I waited 30 days for the owners of the improv to see all the other open mic comics. And I sashayed there one night.
Yeah.
I did 5-6 minutes of really spectacular topical comedy wearing my little jacket and tie. And one of the owners walks right up to me when I got off stage. He goes, hey, man, you want to MC?
Yeah.
I became the house MC very strategically. Clean comedy, the dirty little secret, pays better than dirty comedy because you can do it more places.
Yeah.
Corporate.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that's why I made that. Again, I niched myself. I'm big into niching. So I say, look, as a speaker, one problem you want to solve. I speak on suicide prevention, period, full stop. That's all I talk about. I've got other speeches. If you want to, I can do 45 minutes of stand up at your banquet. I can auctioneer your fundraiser. One, make it two, bid it on, not two, make it two, bid it on, not two. I can do it Spanish and English.
Yeah.
But all I market is suicide prevention. So that's what I ask.
Yeah.
The question I usually get is, I've never done a keynote. How can I ask for $5,000 plus travel?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the secret. You ask for $5,000 plus travel.
Yeah.
Because that perceived value. So I tell them to practice in the mirror, in the bathroom. Keep saying this to yourself. 5,000 plus travel, 5K plus travel, 5 grand plus travel. So it just rolls off your tongue.
Yeah.
I just bumped my feet last week. I've been planning this.
How much are we paying you for this show right now?
Do what?
How much are we paying him for this show right now, Danny?
Yeah. 10 grand.
Do you need to cut it short? Is it by the minute?
Trust me, you can't afford me. What I've been wanting to do, and now I advise my clients, is Ohio Contractor Association decided at the last minute, because their event is at the end of February, that's last minute, they wanted a suicide prevention speaker.
Yeah.
So they're talking about it, and somebody goes, good thing I got Frank King. So they called me and said, hey, man, we looked at your stuff. We want you to come and speak.
Yeah.
So I've been planning to do this. Here's not my chance. He goes, what do you charge? I go, you sitting down? He goes, yeah. I go, it's $12,500 all-inclusive. What's all inclusive? I'll do a keynote. I'll do a breakout. And I'll either MC the entire day, call your charity auction, or I'll do 45 minutes of comedy at your banquet. And I'd never said that out loud before. And unfortunately, they pretty much had the itinerary set. They just needed a speaker. So he goes, we're just gonna have to go with the $7,500. Oh, man. For 45 minutes.
See, there you go.
It's an NLP thing. I gave him 12.5 worst case. Right. So 75 sounds like a bargain. And going forward, somebody's gonna go, yeah, man, 12.5 sounds good.
Yeah.
So it's but I learned that's a learn it. I learned I could do that.
Yeah.
Some people have difficulty speaking in public, but we work on that stage time. oftentimes I'll have them join Toastmasters. Mm-hmm. Great organization. They're 2 7-minute speeches a week. They can almost always get a slot if they're working on something. And that's a great way to begin.
It's stage time. But still, like, some people don't have that. So I guess a lot of what you're saying here is it gets down to that imposter syndrome thing, which is you got to ask for the right amount. Like, believe in yourself. Ask for the right amount. Don't chicken out. And even if you're not a comedian for 20 years, you can still get out there and do this. That's what you're helping people with all the time. But if you had to give advice to somebody that can't get out there, that does feel intimidated by this process, but they have to. Your boss is telling them they got to get out there and deliver a keynote for the company. You got to step into your role. How do you help those people?
If I could find their passion.
Yeah.
Because people go, how do you get confident on stage? Here's the secret. Stand in your truth.
Yeah.
When a meeting planner says to me, we have these evaluation forms everybody filled out. Do you want them? No. I don't care what they think. I do what I do. Suicide prevention is in my DNA. It runs in my family. There are more nuts in my family than in a squirrel turd. And so I had a psychologist bust me one time after a conference. He comes up and he goes, what qualifies you to speak on suicide prevention? You're not a psychiatrist. You're not a psychologist.
Yeah.
And I said to him, because I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like.
Yeah.
And in the silence that followed, I said, look, Chief, I could go to college and learn absolutely everything, but you will never know everything I know. Mm-hmm. Like the taste of gun oil. And that resonates with the crowd. Either 25% of the people in the United States have a mental challenge, and the other 75% probably love somebody who does. I stand in my truth. I was on a college campus somewhere, and they go, comics get a hard time on college campuses now. People get the toe stepped on, they get offended. And are you worried about that? I said, if I was doing stand-up, I'd be very careful.
Yeah.
But I'm on campus talking about suicide prevention. Yeah. If they get their toe stepped on, I don't care.
There you go. And speaking of, this is your thing. This is your passion. This is your truth. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think if you can find the truth and a passion for the speaker, that imposter syndrome will disappear. If they're up there, and most of my clients have something they're really passionate about and want to speak on.
Yeah.
If I can get them to focus on that and only that, then a lot of that stage fright, imposter syndrome, because they're speaking from the heart, not the head at that point. My pitch is, do you want to make a living speaking and a difference?
Right. How do you help them maybe narrow in on what their problem is they want to solve? Because, I think that a lot of people potentially will start off with, they don't want to be too narrow because maybe it won't be the right thing, but because maybe it won't be wanted. But can you help them filter down and focus in on what the actual problem is that they're most passionate about?
Yeah, because if I'm paying attention carefully, and comedy really is a job of watching and listening and then reporting, not so much writing. If I'm watching them and we're talking about a topic, when they hit the topic that they're most passionate about, there's almost a visceral reaction. Their energy goes up. They begin to talk a little faster. Their eyes light up. And I've done this on airplanes with people many times. I sit and I always ask leading questions. To the point where I did a 3-hour flight and the guy goes, what do you do? And I go, I'm a comedian. You're not that funny. I go, well, get your checkbook out. We'll yuck it up. But the question I ask them is, what do you do? And then I ask them, do you enjoy that? And if they go, if they just pause, they don't enjoy it.
Great point.
And then I ask them, okay, if I could wave a magic wand and you could do anything you wanted, make a living and a good one, what would it be? And man, I was sitting next to the number one pilot, the chief pilot for United Airlines one time. He was on his way to Dallas because United and Northwest had merged.
Yeah.
And they're only going to have one chief pilot. And so he was one of two. So he was riding down there to find out if he got the gig.
Yeah.
I go, man, so let's say you don't get the gig and I can wave a magic wand. This is the chief pilot now. What would you do? He said, I'd be a sous chef. What? Did in college, loved every minute of it.
Yeah.
And so people light up oftentimes. They may not know it or notice it, but I notice that's, I say, look, here's the deal. Let's pretend I came over to your house, you're sound asleep. And I shake you out of a sound sleep. And I go, give me 45 minutes on something. And whatever comes out of your mouth, chances are that's what you need to be talking about.
Yeah.
I like that. It sounds like you listen, get curious, and just really focus in on what they have to say.
It's a listening thing. I sold radio one summer when they weren't booking comics on cruise ships. And I realized that the client would almost always write the commercial for me. I'm in an auto repair shop. And I said, again, leading questions. Okay, Bob, tell me about the shop. We're not the home of the 1999 oil change. What are you the home of? 24-month, 24,000-mile nationwide warranty. So that's how I structured the commercial. The we're not the home of the 1999 oil change is a disqualifier. It's driving people away who are tire kickers. They don't want them.
Right.
Yeah.
They want people who value a long nationwide warranty. So they almost always wrote the commercial for me. Mm-hmm. And I had a 95% close rate when most of the salespeople in the company had a 20% close rate. And you know why? Again, work ethic. I'm like Damon. I'm going to outwork, outplay. I made a what they call a spec spot, an actual commercial for everybody I pitched. So that I made an actual commercial, and I would go back out and I would hit the button on the recorder and I go, here's a commercial I made for you. And here's the, what do they call it? You know what? Sales, it's going to be a sale.
Yeah.
Buying signal. I'd play it and they look up and go, can I hear that again?
There you go.
I sold 94% because I took the time and effort. Yeah. I out hustled, outworked. And I went to the effort of create. It's to hold the puppy close. You give somebody a puppy, they're not giving it back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's.
Yeah. 2,629 nights in a row. Outwork everybody. Curiosity. Yeah, just questions. Listening.
Most comics during the daytime. Mm-hmm. I remember I was in a comic condo somewhere. Oh. And the MC sitting on the couch smoking weed watching the Golf Channel. And he says, I need an easier job. I go, dude. Okay, you're sitting on the couch in the middle of the day smoking a joint, and tonight you're going to work 15 minutes. Stop looking. It doesn't get any easier than that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I spent my day on the phone back before cell phones, back when you had like calling cards and they charge you for long distance.
Yeah.
And I was booked a solid year ahead because I was on the phone constantly. That's what I tell people about comedy and speaking. They said, tell me about your job. 85% of it, sales and marketing, 5% writing, 5% performing, 5% traveling. I'm not really a speaker. I'm a marketing and sales guy who speaks.
Yeah, yeah.
If you eat what you kill, and if you don't like sales, you're in the wrong business.
Yeah. I think that happens for a lot of entrepreneurs too. You start out doing this thing that you like to do, but then you realize once you turn it into a business, you're not just doing that thing anymore. You're doing
absolutely. The business owns you.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You can have this specific skill, but at the end of the day, if you can't market it, put it in front of somebody and believe that you're going to help solve their problem, then you're not going to have anybody to sell to.
With speakers, the second step after we figure out what problem they want to solve. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, who has that problem and is willing to pay you? I picked the top six at-risk occupations for suicide. Construction, 1,000 people die by accident, 5,000 die by suicide every year.
Really?
You're 5 times more likely to jump off the building than fall off. You think they got a need?
Wow.
If you pick your ideal clients carefully and you only market to them
and
serve them well and become known among those industries. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because oftentimes entrepreneurs they need to figure out who their ideal client or clients are. I've got a friend who's got a body shop and super successful. And one of the reasons is he's in Eugene, he's in Springfield, which is right next to Eugene, Oregon. It's a very green area. You're never going to hear the words fracking and Oregon in the same breath. And so all of the paints and processes, it's all eco-friendly. It costs a little more, it takes a little longer, but the people in this area, that is well worth, and he's got a 6-week wait. You wreck your car, they'll give you an estimate, but it's going to be 6 weeks before your rental car coverage will run out 2 weeks before it's back. Yeah. People line up because he knows exactly, and he only does one thing, and he does it to one group of people.
Yeah. So you were very strategic about this, but you found your passion. So mental health ended up being your passion. How did that come about?
It's in my DNA. I always want to make a living and a difference, even when I was doing stand-up. 45 minutes of endorphins, people laughing is good. But if you can somehow or other make a difference in their lives.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine wrote a book. Her name's Judy Carter. She wrote a book called The Message of You, Turning Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. And so I said to Judy, I have no idea what I would talk about. I don't know what I have to teach anybody. So she gave me a copy of the book, said, read it, you'll figure it out. I went into it thinking I got nothing. Halfway through, I thought, oh my God, I have two mental illnesses. I came close to killing myself. And as I mentioned, depression and suicide run in my family. My grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I screamed for days.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh man. It's gruesome. It was horror movie, horrible. And if you're already hardwired for it, then it ups the chances that you'll someday seriously consider taking your life. And of course I did. So I realized, look, I could keynote on suicide prevention if I got some training. So I have several certifications in suicide prevention. Mm-hmm. I add my lived experience. And then the humor is what puts me over the top.
Yeah.
I say, look, I put a gun in my mouth. I know what a gun tastes like. And then I weigh a beat. I say to the audience, spoiler alert, I didn't pull the trigger. Nervous laugh. And I say, a friend of mine came up after a keynote the other day, and he said this, hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger? Hey, man, could you try to sound slightly this disappointed? Yeah. In my first TEDx, I said to my little research when I was preparing, I went to the TED.com site to see how other people handle the topic of suicide. Mm-hmm. I figured there'd be dozens of talks on suicide. There were three.
Wow.
I said to the audience, and then it hit me, duh, if you're really good at suicide, you're not going to be recording a TEDx talk.
Yeah, of course, the one you want is the guy who's good at not committing suicide.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a failure. Although if I had pulled the trigger and had a scar right here and just missed, I could charge another $2,500 per keynote.
Yeah. There you go. Frank, you've been in 12 TED Talks. How have you had so much? Is it because you've narrowed in on a subject that is interesting out there, but there's a lot of people doing it? But again, just like with a lot of people who come through Learn It, one of their dreams is to be on a TEDx. What advice would you give for them?
One thing is, it's one idea worth spreading. The one thing that kills most TEDx applications is too much, too many ideas. They just want one. Mm-hmm. The second thing is too much about one idea. There's a reason they ask you to sum it up in a 90-second video. If you can sum it up in 90 seconds, you can do it in 12 to 18 minutes. And the third thing I think is a linchpin is the application isn't creative. Think about this. If you're on a committee and you got 300 applications to go through, are you looking for a reason to give somebody an audition or a reason to throw them in the no pile?
Mm-hmm.
So whatever you put in those first couple of blanks, and I've had two TEDx's where I didn't have to audition. They liked the title and subtitle so much. The first one was Suicide, the Secret of My Success, which is counterintuitive. Dead Man Talking, a play on the movie and book.
Yeah.
And the second one is my favorite, the only one I ever got a standing ovation for, which was Mental Health and the Orgasm, Treat Your Depression Single-Handedly.
Darren, I knew that was coming.
Yeah. And my wife, I had a closing joke and my wife said, don't do it. I said, I'm going to do it and it's going to destroy. And so I, at the end of talking about self-pleasure and all this, I said to the audience, do you guys know why they call it an orgasm? And they're looking at me like, no. And I said, because nobody can spell. Standing ovation.
Frank, how was your advice for people trying to write jokes?
Write jokes. I would buy a back to Judy Carter, by the way.
Really?
She wrote a book called The New Comedy Bible. Hmm. And it's not a joke writing book. She helps you take your stories and find the funny in your stories. She has you do like a brain dump. Give me 30 minutes, write down everything you remember from your first memory. So I wrote about my childhood. I grew up in a neighborhood with 11 girls and me. 11 girls. Yeah. Damon, I didn't even know Little League baseball existed. We played horses. And the problem with that is you get to junior high school, no equestrian team. Yeah. And with 11 girls and one guy back then, when we played doctor, we had a line. It was like playing HMO. Those are two jokes I wrote using Judy's technique. So that's what the new comedy Bible. Yeah. So that way the jokes aren't just jokes. They're about you. Because when you're on stage, a booker often wants to know, when they watch you, tell me something about yourself with your jokes.
Yeah.
I've got a friend whose folks are from Pakistan, very conservative. She's obviously Pakistani or of Pakistani descent. And her opening joke is, got great news. I'm getting married. And my folks are from Pakistan. They've handled everything. I can't wait to meet my husband.
Uh-huh.
Her entire act is about her life as a child of conservative Pakistani parents living in Southern California, dear God.
Yeah.
People were screaming at her during 9/11, go back home. She goes, yeah. I'm from Long Beach, bitches.
So Frank, So I'm sure you've probably been asked this a lot. Whether it's writing jokes, writing scripts, do you look at AI, ChatGPT, and those other tools as a positive or negative? Do you leverage it for, and you recommend leveraging it, or do you think that it's too not,
is it
not
cheating? Not,
is it cheating?
I think it's a good way to develop source material or fodder for jokes. I don't think it's quite qualified yet to write jokes, I don't think. Although you can write a piece and say, please do this in the style of Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And I've seen every episode of every Seinfeld because it's everything pre-2021. Uh-huh. So he can write in his voice. But again, there's something, I believe my mental illness is simply the flip side of my creativity and imagination. Same wiring, same. And I don't, humans can't do what I can do with my sort of strange brain. I can teach you to write, stand up, and perform it. I can't teach you to process the incoming information the way I do. And in comedy, there's an expression. Comedy is tragedy plus time. And the longer you do comedy, the shorter the time. I had a heart attack in the woods with my three dogs, half mile from the road in the car. And I had T-Mobile, so I didn't have cell service. And I know it always is a laugh. Yeah. And I was writing jokes once I got the dogs in the car and I was headed home. I had to drive 2 miles home. My wife, I walk in the house. Honey called 911. I'm having a heart attack. This is what I heard. I'm in the bathroom. I got the fan on. I can't hear you. Okay. I walked half a mile, drove two, and I'm going to die in my hallway. Now, she opened the door, took one look at my face, which was whiter than the Oscars, and she called 911. I'm in the tree. The great thing about having a heart attack is when you get to the hospital, there's no waiting. You get your own little room.
You get right in.
Yeah, right there. Okay. So the nurse says to me, now bear in mind, I'm in a great deal of pain. I'm having a heart attack. Your heart is dying.
Hours. Yeah.
Yeah. You're dying. Yeah. She goes, Frank, I got to ask you a question. Through the pain, I said, honey, I'm married, but I love the way you think. She's trying not to laugh. She goes, no, your full name is Frank Marshall King, but what do you want to be called? Through the pain, I said, Big Daddy. To this day, when I go back to Oregon Heart and Vascular, and somebody sees me from that morning, hey, Big Daddy.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, so I think AI may eventually be able to write like a Seinfeld or a Bill Burr.
Yeah.
I don't know that it can ever reach that level of, because comedy is, like I said, tragedy plus time, pain plus time. I've got 25 minutes in all my cardiac surgeries, but it's...
Yeah.
I've had doctors ask me, did you go to medical school? I go, no, I was just paying attention during the... All doc right. said to me when I was doing my first angiogram. I go, well, he's from Duke. Mr. King, we're going to do an angiogram? I said, well, Dr. Gundry, what's an angiogram? He said, we're going to insert a probe into your femoral artery. I said, how are we going to get it in there? He said, we're going to insert it through an opening in your groin area. I said,
time out.
As far as I know, doc, there's only one opening in my groin area. He's looking at my pants and a six-pack of Dilaudid. I think I'll stick with the heart attack. I wrote that, having a heart attack. Right. I don't know that an AI can process the incoming information the way that I'm on a flight out of Atlanta, Southern flight attendant, often Delta, Southern.
Yeah.
It was a day they said you could now use your iPhone or iPad on takeoff or landing if it was in the airplane mode. But see, the problem with the flight attendant is she's got to tell us that, but it's not written down anywhere. She can do the other safety flight stuff in her sleep, the seat, the floor path lighting, seat cushion, octave. Right. She gets that part and I'm waiting. And she goes, you can tell, you almost look at her face and tell she's thinking. And she goes, ladies and gentlemen, due to new FAA regulation. And then she got inspired. She goes, if you have small equipment, you can continue playing with it. I'm the only one on the plane bent over double laughing. My seatmate thinks I've lost my mind. He goes, what? I go, let's review. Before I can review, she comes back on and goes, if you have large equipment, you're going to have to shove that under the seat in front of you. So I'm down on my knee. Everybody in the plane heard the same thing. I'm the only one that processed it like that fast. Yeah.
Sure.
And here's your little responses. People ask me, how'd you think that up? I didn't think it up. When you heard it, I heard it. I have no idea where that came from.
It's the way your brain goes. It's a nice call out for the whole AI thing. Cause there is that, it's like your thumbprint. Everybody has a unique way that they process. And that still needs to be a part of the
And it's the human experience. Eddie Murphy's first comedy special was
Raw.
Amazing. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Second one was not so good. And Eddie said later, yeah, you know why? Because when I did the first one, I hadn't made it yet.
Yeah.
I was still struggling. The second one, nobody wants to hear what happened in the limo that day.
That's true. Right.
It's the struggle. That's where the funny is. And
that happens to a lot of the rock bands too, right? Their earlier albums are gritty and it's all about the struggle. And then again, they get the fame and get a little softer sometimes. So the stories aren't as great.
Do you guys know that Billy Joel was the piano man in that song? That he, I don't know, he flunked out, but he bailed out of the New York tri-state area. Things hadn't gone well, so he just went to LA and got a job in a bar playing piano. And song's about him playing piano.
That's awesome. And
do you know that Billy Joel is releasing a new album for the first time in about 30 years? I guess he just announced it. I'm a huge Billy Joel fan. And just announced it that I think it's coming out in March.
And my outgoing message, I sing a little Billy Joel.
Can you sing it for us now?
Yeah. You may be right. I may be crazy. But it just may be a lunatic you're looking for. If so, leave me a message. And people, you can hear them laughing on the first part of the message. Oh, dear God, that's funny.
Frank, I noticed this in a picture. What's written on your hand?
Oh, it's notes. I was on a mastermind call today, and everybody gets a chance to talk.
Yeah,
I had 5 things, and I knew I'd forget them.
Yeah,
for an older audience, I go, it's a Palm Pilot.
Yeah,
and the problem with this is I'm always downloading to the sink.
Yeah,
if you watch a couple of my TEDx's, you'll see me actually stop.
Yeah.
And look and go, oh, and the audience starts laughing and I turn. I don't make any bones because the TEDx, you cannot have notes.
Yeah.
There's no prompter.
Yeah.
But they can't tell you not to write on your hand.
Nice.
I make macro. Right,
you can't see who's listening to this. Frank literally has notes written on his hand.
Yeah. So that's a good trick. I remember hearing during The Godfather, Marlon Brando, he didn't memorize his script. He actually had it written on pieces of paper that he taped on the set and on the other actors. So I heard that too. You're working with Marlon Brando. Oh, I'm so excited to work with Marlon Brando. And he comes over to you and says, here, and he puts like his lines on your chest or your head and says, just don't move.
And Yakov Smirnoff, one of the hardest working comics I ever worked with, he would write really large on a legal pad. And then he would take those yellow sheets and he'd tape them to the stage. So the audience can't see him. So he would just lean down, take a sip of his drink, and then, because he wrote material all the time, and so he's constantly updating it, so he couldn't memorize it.
Yeah. That's good. Any other little tips or tricks for being on stage presenting, writing on your hands, paint?
I wrote a lot of topical jokes when I started, because I was a Letterman fan, and I just went by with a blazer and the tie. And the problem with topical jokes, Seinfeld said, look, I love topical jokes, but they burn fast and they're gone. And as much time as I spend writing them, I want them to be evergreen. But I loved news. I'm a news junkie, and so I would get a newspaper, and I would write jokes on index cards. Mm-hmm. I would take the paper, fold it up on stage, and open it up like this. What they can't see is I've got these index cards taped on the, and I pretend like I was turning the page. I sit on the same page, but it had the index cards with the jokes written on them because I wrote them that afternoon.
Yeah. And just work it like you're making them up right then.
Yeah. The trick is making them. I worked with Robin Williams a couple times.
Yeah.
And people go, he's so creative. I saw 2 shows back to back, almost identical.
Really? Are you kidding me?
Nope. And the only thing changed was the people he talked to in the audience, but same jokes.
Uh-huh.
Just different audience members. He did a lot of audience work. So yeah, it wasn't, but the magic was he made it look like it just occurred to him.
Yeah.
Comics, that's really the trick is when I get on a cruise ship and I say, look, I'm happy to be here. Hell, I'm happy to be anywhere. I flew in on a commuter plane. You know what that means? Commuter plane means my travel agent's a dead man. Tell me, big plane. It's a Boeing 7.7. The 3 guys in front of me are Weebles. I got to make them believe I flew in that day on that plane when it happened 7 years ago.
Yeah. Sounds like acting, Frank. That sounds a lot like acting.
It is a lot about acting. It's you just have to make them believe. I've been doing the same basic act for a long time, but you have to energize it in such a way that you guys are not going to believe this, whatever it happened to be.
Yeah.
Like the Delta flight. I flew in on a Delta flight. And flying, any kind of, when you're traveling is a great source of comedy because there's always, I'm in an airport one time and the plane's delayed, mechanical, whatever. Everybody's grumpy. And we're standing under television and the television's playing CNN. And the guy next to me goes, "Hey, how do we get this TV turned to Fox News?" So in an equally loud voice, I said, so everybody in the area could hear me, "You kill me first." And the entire gate area, everybody's laughing. They're still in a bad mood, but they're laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
I tried out to be a policeman, 12 different departments during the last recession because speaking comedy dropped off 80%. I always wanted to be a cop. So I tried out with 12 departments. They can't not hire you based on age. If you can pass the physical fitness test, and by the way, I did 4 times at age 52, the oldest guy in the state of Washington ever to pass the law enforcement physical fitness test. They have to at least consider you. So I had several oral boards. And they go, "Well, Frank, what's the connection with comedy and cops?" I go, "We're both paid observers. A, we see things that other people walk by and never give a second thought to. And B, we have to read the crowd. You have to be able to, like, roll up on a scene. There's people milling around in the middle of the road. You got to be able to figure out the temperature of the crowd. Is there a particular, is somebody leading this? And most importantly, the first thing you say will either escalate the problem or de-escalate the problem."
Yeah.
And a comic can come off, like I said, like heckling. Young woman screamed at me. She's drunk. They're throwing her out. She's near the door. All of a sudden, she's turning back toward me. I'm guessing she heard something sounded like her name because drunks are voice activated. And she screams, "F you!" And without even thinking, I said, "Not even for practice." That's the connection. If you can come across like that, that fast, without thinking,
then
cops have to do the same thing. They roll up whatever they say. It's got to be. Yeah, so that was, and I thought it'd be fun to be a cop. I wanted to be a cop for 5 years in a car with another guy. And during that time, work with the canine unit as the guy in the big stuff suit. And then get a dog and spend 5 years in the car with a dog. And then, and my training officer goes, "And then you're now 62. I go, "Yeah, I got it. I want to work my way up the department in the PR department for the Seattle PD. Because I think if I was head of PR, if I had to do the news conferences, can you imagine a comic doing news conferences?
I would
be the king of sound bites.
I don't think any doubt about that.
Yeah. Some idiot says, ask some stupid question. "Oh, look, dude, save your breath so you can blow up your date when you get home tonight. Next." Eminently quotable.
Comedian, it would be a great experience. I don't know that I'd mind getting pulled over if it was a cop comedian.
They asked me, cops, people say things to them, really nasty things to them. I go, "Dude, I've been doing comedy for 2 decades. There's nothing
you've heard it all
that hasn't been said to me or about me, my family, I had a guy pull a gun on me one night
from the
audience.
So it really is like being a cop.
They loved the guy before me, Pat Miller, a friend of mine, big guy, 3 feet wide, 3 feet tall, 300 pounds. He's walking across the platform they'd built for the comics and a board broke and everybody could hear it. And best ad lib I've ever heard. He turns to the audience. He goes, "Nobody panic. It's just a stage I'm going through." They loved him. They hated me.
Okay, yeah.
Halfway through my set, I look down over the shoulder of the guy in the front row is the hand of the guy in the second row with a nickel-plated 38 hammer back pointed right at me. So I turn sideways to make a smaller target, lower my elbow to cover my vital organs, not my first rodeo, and just waited. And finally, it's East Tennessee, Kingsport, Tennessee. A woman in the back yelled out, "Hey, either shoot him or put it away."
All right, Frank. Thank you for all your time today, Frank.
We've kept you long enough. I think that's the final image to end on, isn't it?
I think so. It's
shoot him or put it away.
I hope that's what you had in mind.
That's exactly what you had in mind. Frank, where can people get in touch with you?
I have a huge presence on LinkedIn. Also mentalhealthcomedian.com, mentalhealthcomedian.com.
Yeah.
Brilliant. You can find me some of my TEDx talks have made it to YouTube. Some haven't. It's a longer story. The TEDx people don't like me. You're not supposed to have more than 4. I have 12.
Yeah.
I've learned how to game the system. It's like being a card counter in Vegas at a blackjack table. It's not illegal, but they really don't like it.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they haven't put up one of mine on, they haven't put the last eight of mine up on YouTube. So what I do is, after the fifth one, when they didn't put it up, I donate a videographer to each event.
Oh,
and everybody gets an additional camera angle, and I get a bootleg copy. I can prove I was there.
Uh-huh. Nice. Awesome. Brilliant. Frank, thank you so much for taking the time. I mean, I can't even count all the different things that I feel like people could have learned from this. And so much of it connects to things that we talked about all the time. You talked about curiosity, the importance of hard work, listening, finding your truth, stepping into your truth. That's the way to really make it. And plus, all the little tips and tricks is brilliant. Thanks for the time.
You're welcome. And I've got a speaker who does personal development. And I told him Damon's story the other day about being a 70-year-old baseball player.
Yeah.
Because he's big on, it's your attitude. It's not, you know, not what other people think of you. It's what you think of yourself that gets in the way. And I told Damon's story about me.
Yeah.
17, wanted to run home, cry to mama because the coach said.
That's right. Yeah.
Let me end this as a comedian would end this. You guys want to hear this?
Let's hear it. Yeah.
Okay. Listen, if you enjoyed this podcast, and God, I hope you did, please write, review, and subscribe. And tell your friends. If you didn't like this podcast, we hope you've got no friends.
Thank you, Frank.
Print.
All right.